All right, we're calling the meeting of the Environment, Climate, and Legacy to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:07 at this time on Thursday, February 15th, and we now have quorum. We have just a number of items, not a lot, on our agenda today. We'll begin hearing Senate File 3505, the LCCMR bill, and also we'll reserve a large chunk of the time to get reports, updates from our agency, the DNR, and MPCA. So I will proceed to the other side to present our LCCMR bill, Senate File 35, and like to pass the gavel to Vice Chair McCune. That's all yours, and welcome back, members, staff, and also welcome all of you who join us today.
Thank you, Chair Herr. And I believe the bill number is 3507. Is that correct? I think
that is correct.
Okay, very good.
I might have misspoken, but
I just wanted to make sure we had the number correct. Okay, so this is the first item on our agenda, Senate File 3507, Environmental and Natural Resources Trust Fund Appropriations. Chair Herr, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair McCune. Senate File 3507 is our LCCMR bill, our Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. The LCCMR committee is comprised of 17 members, 5 from the Senate, 5 from the House, 5 appointed by a citizen, appointed by the governor, and 1 from each of the body, the Senate and the House. We spent in the summer and fall of this year on the process, which led us to vetting and approve, with my majority support, of this legislative package here before you. And there are 101 recommended project with budget of $79.644 million fundings from the Environmental Trust Fund. I want to thank Senator Green, who's my vice chair in the committee, and Senator Kelly Morrison, who also members of the LCCM committee. Also outside this committee is Senator Dietzit and Senator Westrom. Now I'll call Director Becca Nash to go through the bill, and folks can, Madam Chair, at your own discretion, whether we have question or not, we'll see how that go. And I'd like to refer the presentation going through section by Director Nash.
Thank you for joining our committee today. After you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Again, my name is Becca Nash, and I'm the director of the LCCMR, the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. And I will give you a brief overview of the LCCMR, the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, the process that we followed to develop the recommendations that are before you today, and then I'll do a quick walkthrough of the bill. We've also provided some handouts in your packets as well. So as a reminder, the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund is a permanent fund in the state treasury that was created by voters through constitutional amendment to support activities that protect, conserve, preserve, and enhance Minnesota's air, water, land, fish, wildlife, and other natural resources. It's funded with proceeds from the Minnesota State Lottery, as well as income that's invested by the State Board of Investment. The LCCMR, as Senator Herr said, is a 17-member joint commission, and they are responsible for making recommendations to the legislature on how money, primarily from the trust fund, is appropriated, and then for conducting oversight of those approved projects and associated expenditures. LCCMR is also assisted by its own nonpartisan staff, including myself. LCCMR's typical recommendations process results from a multi-stage competitive process that starts with our annual release of our request for proposals. Proposals are reviewed, members hear presentations, research projects undergo additional external scientific peer review, and then the top proposals are selected and must be approved by at least 11 of the 17 members to become LCCMR's recommendation to the legislature. The amount that was available this year for appropriation was $79,644,000. In response to our RFP, we received 218 proposals requesting approximately $174 million. 101 projects were selected by the Commission for recommendation to the legislature, and those recommendations also include changes to and carry forwards from prior year's appropriations. So unless there are any questions, I'll keep going with the bill walkthrough.
Please do. Thank you.
Okay. Subdivisions 3 through 10 represent the LCCMR's priority areas as included in our request for proposals, and the first of which is foundational natural resources data and information. This starts on page 2, subdivision 3. It includes approximately $14.9 million in appropriations for 28 projects. Subdivision 4 is water resources, and this includes approximately $6.9 million in appropriations for 13 projects. Subdivision 5 is environmental education and includes approximately $11.2 million for 22 projects. Subdivision 6 is aquatic and terrestrial invasive species and includes about $8.3 million for 4 projects. Subdivision 7 is air quality, climate change, and renewable energy. This is $4.8 million for 5 projects. Subdivision 8 is methods to protect or restore land, water, and habitat, and this is about $11 million for 16 projects. Subdivision 9 is land acquisition, habitat, and recreation. This includes $20 million for 10 projects. Subdivision 10 is administrative and emerging issues, and this includes approximately $2 million for 4 appropriations. Subdivisions 11 through 17 are conditions of funding that typically get included every year. What you see before you is the same as it has been in previous years, with one exception, and that is on page 39. There's a provision that requires that any proposed conservation easements be sent to LCCMR for review before closing. The standard time has been 10 days, and we are requesting 20 days to give us a little bit more time to do that review. Subdivision 18, starting on page 43, includes those funding carry forwards. These are projects that were previously funded and just need a little bit more time to complete their outcomes. And then sections 3 through 7 include technical changes to prior appropriations. These start on page 47. The first one relates to the National Loon Center, and the National Loon Center requested a change in where they're constructing their project. And so the language, the corrections that we've provided would allow that, and also puts in some standard appropriation language for acquisitions as well as for capital construction projects, as were passed in the laws of 2023. The rest of the technical changes are releasing projects from revenue requirements to return earned revenue to the trust fund. And those projects affected are Crane Lake Voyageurs National Park Visitor Center, Silver Bay Trailhead, Floodwood Campground, and a project called Developing Markets for Continuous Living Cover Crops. That concludes my comments, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for your presentation of the bill. Senator Herr, before we open it up to questions and discussion from members, do you have any final comment?
We've spent long hours and during the summer and the fall, and I also thank the staff of the LCCMR for getting us together, get us in check, and I think we worked quite well So I'm bringing before you to get this Senate File 3507 passed as recommended by the LCCMR members. And if there's no questions, I would like to move. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Senator Green, you have a question or a comment?
I have a couple of questions,
yeah.
Madam Chair. Thank you. First, to either Senator Herr or Director Nash, when we were going through these, there was, there is 2,890 acres of land either purchased or going to easements in this. And when we were going through them, there was some proposals that where the property was already either in easement through a government agency or was already owned in some way, and then there's funds through the LCCMR, and I believe that there's stipulations that you're not supposed to be able to use funding to buy those lands, and some of them we took out. Is there anything in these lands now that slipped through that we're using LCCMR money to, or Environmental Trust Fund money to purchase land or that either has already owned or has easements on it?
Chair Herr or Director Nash?
Madam Chair, Senator Green, you are correct that any, by statute, any land to be acquired that is already partially or entirely in public ownership would require additional determination by the LCCMR and would have to be voted on by at least 11 of the 17 members. There were a couple proposals that came before the commission. The commission did not approve those, and those are not in the bill.
Senator Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so were all of them taken out or were some approved?
After you.
Madam Chair, members, they were not approved.
Okay, thank you. Another,
Senator
Madam Chair.
Green.
Okay, on page 5 of the bill, for the Voyager's Wool Project, is there anyone from the U here to answer questions on this? Because this money is going to the U, University of Minnesota.
Director Nash or Chair Herr, do you wish to respond to the question from Senator Green?
Senator Green and Chair McCune, not that I know of that anyone from the University of Minnesota is here.
Okay. Madam Chair, then if I'll just ask two questions. If you can answer them, that's fine. If not, I would like to get some answers from the U, and I'll maybe get those on my own. But just for the record, on the Voyager's Wolf Project, it's nearly $1 million that's going to be going out for this for more studies. Well, this is phase three of that study, and I'm wondering if either the Senator Herr or Director Nash can walk through really briefly what was done in phases one and two, and as we move forward, are they going to have some conclusions on this, or are we going to continue to study this?
Chair Herr or Director Nash?
Madam Chair, I can give that a shot. Senator Green, members, that is correct. This would be the third phase of funding for the Voyager's Wolf Project. Generally speaking, the Voyager's Wolf Project is about studying the behavior of wolves in the summertime, the spring, summer, and fall. Evidently, much of the information that the state of Minnesota has about wolves is based on data that's been collected during the winter, and they're finding that that is not necessarily applicable to what's going on in the rest of the year. So that is the main premise of the project. Phase one was in 2017, and in that project, they documented alternative food sources for wolves, such as beaver, fish, and berries. The whole project is about collecting data, so there are some findings that were particularly innovative that they released and shared with the public, but the gist of it was that they developed and collected a lot of data about the alternative food sources of wolves. Phase two was in 2020. This project documented wolf predation rates on beavers, adult and calf moose, and adult and fawn deer within Voyager's National Park and evaluated the relationships between abundance and predation. So as the populations of beavers go up, how does that affect their predation on other animals? Phase three, they're going to be gathering additional key data on landscape effects and wolf pup recruitment. They cumulatively have published 24 peer-reviewed publications, and the idea is that they are intensively studying the dynamics, the prey-predator dynamics, and that they're creating a long-term data set that will be available so that species management is based on the best available science.
Thank you, Director Nash. Senator Green, follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that, Director Nash. The reason that I ask, and we did do discuss this some in committee as well, because that's, $1 million is a lot of money. And if you read through the project in the book, it looks like it's mostly setting up cameras and compiling data. And so when I see phase three, and sometimes, phases go on forever, I'd like to know if we're getting anything in a conclusion on that. And I know that there was some things within the bill, thankfully, this year that is going to require some conclusions to come forward, if I'm not mistaken, on some of, not on this project, but on some other projects we're going to be looking at. And I hope to do that with a lot of other projects. Now, one more question. I don't know if you're going to be able to answer this, but for the record, I want this information from the university, and that would be on page 8, starting at line 824. We're giving almost $700,000 to the university to study movements of deer in the suburban areas. And looking through the project, over half of that is going to be going to two associates. But in this particular case, there's no name under those associates. It just says postdoctoral associates. And I'd like to know who they are, and if they are full-time employees with the U, or who's going to be doing those studies. And like I said, I don't expect you to know that today, but I would like to find that out. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Green. Members, any further questions or discussions on Senate File 3507? Yes, Senator Kunesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator and Commissioner, for sharing this information with us. As I look through here, I'm seeing that there are a lot of programs for youth and students, especially when it comes to climate and natural habitat. And I want to call that out and say, as a former teacher and having lived in very rural Minnesota and now live in suburbia and having lived in the urban core, that there, all of these things are so very, very similar. I mean, I live in a first ring suburb and we have deer all over the place. We have wild turkeys, we have all of these habitats, all these things that we always think we're going to see in greater Minnesota or outside of the urban core. And some of these core programs are for our urban communities as well as, greater Minnesota. And I just want to say thank you for paying attention to the entirety of Minnesota when you are looking at some of these really valuable programs and stretching the funding out in a way that, in this place and time, we are allowing for communities and youth to understand and study. But those are those are our future scientists. Those are our future naturalists and environmentalists. And so as I look through this, I kind of think, wow, I wish I was a kid again and be able to participate in some of these things. So I just wanted to say thank you for really a well-rounded portfolio of the uses of those dollars in the way that they are.
Thank you, Senator Kunesh. Any other discussion members?
I would also echo Senator Kunesh's comments. This is a gift to the people of Minnesota, and I am so thankful for all of the work that you all do and the committee that works on putting this together. It is a tremendous amount of work, all of the proposals that are heard and vetted, and all of the work that the people of Minnesota are doing around these very valuable projects, the research that's being done. I mean, 24 peer-reviewed public, I mean, wow, Wow, it's an amazing use of the public's resources to gather that kind of information, to encourage more activity in the outdoors, to bring more people, to connect people to our environment that is so amazing here in the state of Minnesota. So I just, I'm so thankful for this. With that, I didn't want to neglect if there is anybody who has joined the committee today in the audience who would like to testify in favor or in opposition in any way to the bill that is before us at this time, Senate File 3507. Are there any people who have joined us who would like to offer any additional testimony? Okay, not seeing any. Senator Herr, do you have any closing comments before we look to a motion on the bill?
Okay, thank you, Chair McHugh, and thank you, Senator Kunesh, for your good comments, and Senator Green, thank you for serving as a vice chair of the committee, and we'll connect you with the University of Minnesota with the information that you requested. But appreciate kind word, but it's not really just kind word, but it's the right word, things to say and the right things to do for our future generation. Each of us, you know, are here for a period perceived to be 4 years, and in 10 years, in 20 years, 30 years, perhaps some of us will not be here or even be around, and so it's always good to create stewardship for our future generation, and this is a good bill, strong bill for that. And so I'd like to ask members to support, and I will motion that we pass Senate File 35 out of this committee. 3507.
Okay, thank you, Senator Herr. Very good. Okay, thank you very much, Senator Herr. On the motion that Senate File 3507 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate Finance Committee, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. The motion prevails.
Thank you,
Senator Herr.
Okay, and next on our agenda, thank you, Vice Chair McHugh, for chairing this committee while I presented Pat's last bill. So next on our agenda is getting implementation updates from Department of Natural Resource, and I'd like to ask the agency to come forward. That's already there, Mr. Bob Meyer, and our Commissioner, Sarah Stroman. So, I think as an outline, I think our testifier will talk about the Get More project, the community tree replacement, EAB respond grant, invasive carp report, elk reduction, and native fish report, and minnow stakeholders group recommendation. So this will be the agenda we'll hear in presentation. So, Commissioner, you may go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Herr and members. I'm Sarah Stroman. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. And with me is Assistant Commissioner Bob Meyer. We have some other folks who are going to come up as we go through that list of updates that Chair Herr mentioned. We're really happy to be here today to give you a progress update on a number of items, including some of the budget items that you all passed last year, as well as some of those important resource protection topics. And so I am going to start with the Get Out More, Modernize Outdoor Recreation Experiences Investments, as Chair Herr mentioned. And then some of our other directors and staff will come in and address the other topics.
Commissioner Stroman, sorry to interrupt you, but I'm going to lay a little plan here for our members. You know, in case you have a question, I think maybe we'll just, you feel free to ask as the presenter goes, so that it's not a lot for you to remember at the end of this testimony. So feel free to ask, but I will limit to two questions per each moment that we take Q&A. Then we'll move on. Okay, so thank you. Thank you for waiting, Commissioner, and you may continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you want to go to the next slide? So hopefully you all remember the incredible opportunity in the budget that you passed last year. We are really excited about the Get Out More, as I said, modernize outdoor recreation experiences and the transformational opportunity this represents for Minnesota. I don't have to tell any of you what our natural resources and our outdoor experiences mean to Minnesotans. They are central to our identity, they are fundamental to our economy and essential to our health and our quality of life. And the Get Out More really was a once-in-a-generation opportunity to invest in renewing and evolving our state's outdoor recreation experiences. We know we already have an outstanding outdoor recreation system. It's fueled by our diverse landscapes and high-quality natural resources. And at the same time, we know that that system is showing its age and it needs some work. And as we do this work, we can do it in a way that is responsive to a changing climate and in a way that increases outdoor access for underserved Minnesotans. So to refresh your memory, we have $150 million in the Get Out More initiative. That was focused, is originally proposed and is directed by the legislature in five key areas. Those areas are making outdoor experiences easier to access and more welcoming to visitors, making improvements to campgrounds, modernizing boating access, enhancing fisheries and fishing infrastructure, and restoring streams and modernizing water-related infrastructure. Also, just to refresh your memory, this $150 million came from a mix of general fund appropriations and capital budget appropriations, as you see on this slide, broken down into those five categories. The opportunity that we saw at DNR, as I said, was to make transformational modernization improvements to Minnesota's outdoor recreation experiences. And so to do that, we wanted to take a programmatic approach to this $150 million. We want to make sure that each of the individual investments we make add up as a total into something that truly is transformational. And so the decisions that we have made around funding allocations were made programmatically. They were made collaboratively across all of the divisions at DNR. And we believe this will allow us to be more effective, more efficient with the dollars, and more impactful with those investments. I'll also note that this approach included robust public engagement through the decisions we have made so far, and that engagement will continue as we implement those dollars on the ground and then as Minnesotans are able to get out and actually enjoy those experiences. We started with a set of foundational principles, some of which were found in the appropriation language and some of which are just perspectives we brought to these dollars. Those are first to modernize existing facilities, resources, and services that we already have. This is really about modernizing and renewing existing investments, not building new things. Secondly, we had a principle of engaging with Minnesotans. As I said, we talked with a lot of people about their priorities and DNR priorities and where there was overlap. And as I said, we're going to continue to do that engagement as we build out that work. Third, we wanted to pay particular attention to communities that have been underserved by outdoor experiences in Minnesota in the past, whether that's because of geography or income or the type of recreation they engage in. We want all Minnesotans to feel welcome in these spaces and in these experiences. And then finally, we wanted this work to build off existing programs, existing priorities within the DNR so that we can be as efficient with the dollars as possible. As part of this, we created something called the Investment Optimization Team. This is an internal team, and as you can see from the slide here, the picture in our head is that this team really serves as air traffic control for all of the projects that will be undertaken with this $150 million Get Out More investment. The idea of the Investment Optimization Team is to leverage existing systems within the agency to execute the higher volume of projects, and essentially for all projects to take off and land on time and on budget. And included in that is that public, without losing those principles of the public engagement and the communication. And so as you can think about, just an example, there are a number of projects that will need permitting. They will need contracting. They will need perhaps environmental review. We don't want all of the projects to get to those places at the same time and need the same resources. So this air traffic control system essentially manages the flow so that we can move everything through the system and remain on budget and on time. I'll switch now to walking through those five categories and where the investments are going and what Minnesotans will start to see. So the first category is enhancing access and welcoming new users. This was allocated $35 million. And as you all have heard me say many times, we believe very firmly that Minnesota's public lands and our outdoor recreation facilities should be accessible and welcoming for all Minnesotans to enjoy. And we have a number of facilities where modernization is needed to meet the needs of today's users. So this $35 million will be invested in wide-ranging accessibility enhancements at state parks and recreation areas, as well as wildlife management areas. It will provide accessible outdoor recreation equipment for use on state lands, such as our track chairs, which have been famously popular in our state parks, some of our state parks. It will help us improve access in parking lots, roads, and signage across DNR's units of the outdoor recreation system, and then also enhance accessibility and resiliency on paved state trails and unpaved hiking trails. Just so you can see a breakdown of how we intend to allocate programmatically this $35 million, you can see how the percentages in this pie chart going to trails, roads, wayfinding or signage, accessibility, and then equipment. Specifically, we have begun to identify the high priority roads that are key for providing access to Minnesotans. This is access to areas for camping, for hunting, for access to public water, and the map there on the slide depicts those high priority sites that we have identified that we will be using to further winnow down for investment. We've also identified a number of state parks as priorities for receiving accessibility improvements. That includes Glacial Lake, Lake Bemidji, Jay Cook, Banning, Grand Portage, Great River Bluffs, Wild River, Monson Lake, Sibley, Fort Ridgely, Rice Lake, Flandreau, and Fort Snelling. Examples of the kind of accessibility projects include improving access to buildings by adding door openers, upgrading amenities to include accessible height counters, picnic tables, bathrooms, those kinds of smaller scale projects. We also then are undertaking an evaluation to identify three parks that would receive more comprehensive accessibility work. Additionally, we are evaluating 75 facilities at wildlife management areas. These are facilities have been built for the express purpose of providing hunting or wildlife viewing opportunities for people with disabilities. That includes 64 hunting blinds for deer, turkey, and waterfowl, and then the 11 remaining facilities are a combination of wildlife viewing structures, boat docks, trails, or accessible parking lots. What we have learned from some of our accessibility partners is that many of these facilities are considered to be only partially accessible, although we advertised them and they were built for their accessibility. So we want to evaluate each one of those and make the improvements that are necessary for them to be fully accessible. The next category is revitalizing camping and related infrastructure. We had about $9.5 million here between the general fund and the bonding. The general fund was for a modernization pilot at one campground. We have selected Miniopa State Park for that pilot. And that's primarily because we looked at use, need, and geographic location. And Miniopa rose to the top with its key location near Mankato, the age and condition of the current campground, and the fact that we've seen an increase in visitors at the park, particularly since the bison arrived at the park. So what we will be doing there in this pilot is creating larger and more modern sites and facilities, providing electric service at the sites, creating universal accessibility, improvements to property access and accessibility throughout the park so visitors can experience not just the campground but the other amenities Miniopa has to offer, and then also landscaping to provide an enhanced environment as well as enhanced climate resilience. And then the second piece of this investment is $4.5 million to improve the wastewater system at Myrie Big Island State Park. It is in need of renewal in order to facilitate continued camping at that site, and it will be one that will be designed to support climate resilience. The third category in Get Out More is enhancing fishing and fishing infrastructure. This part had an appropriation of $60 million. You can see the breakdown here, with the vast majority going to two full modernization projects, one at our Waterville warm water hatchery, the other at Crystal Springs cold water hatchery, as well as then $12 million of other hatchery improvements, and then the remaining $5 million towards shore fishing opportunities. Specifically in the hatchery modernization projects, we will be able to incorporate new advances in hatchery technology. As you heard me say many times last session, many of our hatcheries were built in the 1950s and they're still operating on 1950s technology. So we are looking forward to be able to use modern technology to provide full biosecurity against disease and aquatic invasive species, recirculating aquaculture system to recycle 95% or approximately 95% of the water we use. We'll have the flexibility to rear multiple strains or species simultaneously, which will allow us to be more responsive and flexible with stocking options. And we will also be optimizing ponds, replacing aging pump and pipeline infrastructure, and creating safe fish kettles. The shore fishing investments, I'm really excited about this. We know there are a lot of Minnesotans that do not have access to a boat and rely on our shorelines or piers for their fishing opportunities. So this investment will, number one, allow us to target spots that are good for fishing, where people actually have a chance of catching fish from the shore. It'll allow us to repair or replace existing fishing piers, enhance existing shore fishing sites, as well as explore new opportunities that are close to communities and work hopefully with local partners to do that. Just to give you a little bit more detail here, work is already underway at seven hatchery sites to make those improvements I mentioned. And then for the shore fishing work, we are actually hiring a project manager to help work with partners to determine the sites and implement the investment at those sites. And I believe the job is actually posted and open right now if anyone wants to help us or know someone who would like to help us determine and design shore fishing opportunities. I was thinking actually maybe that was a better job than the one I have now. I'm kidding, it's not, but it sounds like a lot of fun. Modernizing boating access. We had a $35 million investment here. We are going to be allocating $30 million of that to large-scale projects. About 40 to 60 of those we will be able to implement. That'll include a combination at sites of accessible features, parking, boat ramps, as well as stormwater improvements, areas to do aquatic invasive species prevention work, healthy shorelines, making sure that we are keeping our water clean, and also accessible non-motorized ramp for people enjoying paddle sports. The remaining $5 million will be for smaller scale projects for public water accesses that are not in need of a full rehab. So examples of this might include longer launch ramps, wider drive lanes, wider, longer parking stalls, and that improved stormwater management with healthy shorelines. So we anticipate a total of about 115 projects with this $35 million. We have been working with local governments and other partners to develop a list of approximately 98 candidate public water accesses that would be the recipient of this modernization work. And we are continuing to evaluate those, but the map there on the right shows the distribution of those 98 sites that have been identified. And as I said, we will continue to refine that list in conversation with partners. These sites have been prioritized based on the level of use that they receive, the geographic distribution, and the greatest need based on the condition of the site, especially the accessibility and stormwater control issues, the opportunities for shoreline protection, as well as AIS prevention. And then last, but certainly not least, the final category is restoring streams and modernizing water-related infrastructure. This was a $10 million investment, and we will be allocating this to replace culverts and bridges, to improve stream ecology, remove or modify dams, to restore habitat, to enhance fish passage, and renovate other water control structures to address the impacts of climate change and support waterfowl production. The first phase of the package is a $5.6 million investment. We've coordinated across our DNR divisions, as well as selected from our existing stream restoration prioritization list. Projects on this list have already been vetted with external partners and stakeholders like watershed districts, soil and water conservation districts, counties, lake associations, and other partners. And so we've already had the opportunity with this list to consider the type of project, the scale of the impact, the critical habitat that would be improved, the level of community support, and the project's feasibility. The specific projects we've selected for phase one involve channel restoration, dam modification, and transitions from culvert to bridge. They are located around the state and will all improve recreational opportunities. In addition, we will be reconnecting 63 miles of streams. So not only will that improve recreation, it will lead to beneficial outcomes such as fish habitat, increased fish passage, and adding natural meanders back to allow higher flows to once again access the floodplain. Finally, we'll see some improvement in recreational safety by converting dams to safer systems, and we are excited to kickstart these investments this spring. You see some of the examples here that are already underway as far as the dam removal modification and culvert replacement components of this category. We will soon be looking with the remaining funds to get to that $10 million, a second phase of investments here. And then finally, I want to note, because we are talking about investments that Minnesotans will see and experience, there has been a lot of media and public interest in this. We have been talking about this work. And we have enjoyed local, regional, statewide, and even some national media coverage of the Get Out More initiative. And we hope to continue to engage with partners and the public and communicate progress in this vein. One of the ways that you and the public can stay up to date is to follow our Get Out More webpage on the DNR's website. Right now, it has descriptions of each of these five categories, talks about the work that is part of those categories. There's some videos so people can understand what that work looks like. And we will continue to update that website with our progress. And we look forward to celebrating the success of these investments with all of you and with Minnesotans as they get out to enjoy these outdoor experiences. With that, Mr. Chair, that concludes our information. We'll update on the Get Out More initiative.
Thank you, Commissioner, for your reports. Any question from members? All comments? I do have questions, and this is just an educational questions, you know, on the hatchery section. You probably talked to me at some point already, but just for the general public and us to know where's our, and I'm glad that we get the funding to improve all the, but I just want to get a little number of, you know, the amount of fish or that we release or supply to where, you know, if you can give us a little background on that. And I would like, I'm just out of curiosity, want to hear from you.
Mr. Chair and members, yeah, that's a great question. Our hatchery system is really important in ensuring angling opportunities across Minnesota. We are fortunate in Minnesota that a lot of our lakes, particularly in the northern part of the state, have naturally reproducing populations of fish. But we have other parts of the state, particularly southern Minnesota, for example, where walleye don't naturally reproduce. And so the angling opportunities there exist because of the work that our fisheries staff do at those hatcheries to produce fish and then stock them in lakes. The reason, and we can certainly get you numbers if you're interested in numbers, but the reason the Waterville and the Crystal Springs hatcheries in particular are so important is Waterville is our one of our primary warm water hatcheries that produces walleye that gets stocked all across, as I said, particularly southern Minnesota, but across we also produce pike and muskie there. It's also the location where we've been doing particular research and now producing the lower Minnesota strain of walleye. So part of the work that we do there is to find those, like the work we've done with the trout in the Driftless area too, those genetic strains of fish that are best adapted to certain parts of Minnesota. So that research component to make sure that we are stocking the fish that can survive the best are really important. Crystal Springs is a cold water hatchery. That's where we produce trout and splake, and a lot of those fish go to Senator Housechild's district, Senator McEwen's district, up to the north for our northern trout anglers. And so, you know, depending on what kind of fish we're producing, those fish do go generally statewide and are really important to providing those diverse opportunities for people.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. And, you know, it's fascinating. We here serving, represent our district and also making sure that our ecosystem and our natural resource are you know, at the highest quality as possible. You know, fish, our natural is actually quite captivating at time, you know, and so, you know, look forward to the progress and as natural resource prevail and grow, we always reminded of our humanity. We're all going back to our little children's stage, you know, and would like to see all that touch and feel. So when all this project is completed or in some form, I would personally like to come and visit. You know, a show and tell is very, 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 very important. So thank you for your presentation and for also answering my question as well. And if members don't have any question. Thank you, Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner. Oh, you do. Oh, all right. Senator Housechild. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I have a funny question. So when you think about Get Out More, I'm really pleased with all these investments. I was authoring the hatcheries and the boat landings and a lot of the things that are really critical. So just yes or no question. When you think about getting out more in Minnesota, is northern Minnesota the best place to get out more? Yes or no is fine. I'm just
Commissioner.
Kidding. Thank you, Commissioner.
Yeah, oh, no, okay, all right. But we had visited some part during our tour. I think it was LCSMR tour up north. So Senator Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for all your work. Just a quick question about, you know, $150 million. It's a lot of money. I'm wondering what more ballpark, what percentage is kind of deferred maintenance and what is newly discovered needs?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morrison, great question. What I would say on that is we really designed this with modernization in mind. So it was less about deferred maintenance, although clearly the maintenance status of some of the facilities is being calculated into our decision to invest there. But we're not merely doing maintenance. We really are modernizing that facility to provide for the needs of Minnesotans today. So that's the goal of this entire. That would contrast with, for example, our asset preservation dollars in a bonding bill, which truly are about deferred maintenance, keeping the current function going forward as opposed to enhancing that function to provide something new.
Thank you. I appreciate that response.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner, and appreciate you coming, and we'll talk more outside committee. Also, thank you, Deputy Commissioner, as well. So next on our agenda here, and feel free to stay, and next on our agenda here is the Community Tree Replacement, or MOASH Board Response Grants. Patty Tiller, Director of Forestry Division. Oh, she is right there. Okay. For the record, have you self introduced and go on from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Patty Thielen. I am the director of the Forestry Division for Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Emerald ash borer, or EAB, was discovered in Minnesota in 2009. And you see on the slide, this is the Department of Agriculture quarantine map for EAB to show the current spread of infestation. In the 15 years since then, Minnesota has been able to slow the spread of this devastating invasive insect through education, collaborative partnership between state agencies and with nonprofits, counties, and cities working together to support communities, and some occasional help from very cold winters. We haven't gotten any help that way this year. We've also gotten funding to help communities prepare for and respond to emerald ash borer. 46 out of the 87 counties in Minnesota are currently under quarantine, with 8 counties added in calendar year 23. About 20% of our community forest trees are ash, 1 out of 5. Some communities are as much as 60% ash, and that really illustrates the issue we have here. EAB kills about 99% of trees once it enters a community. Communities are really at the greatest risk and in the greatest immediate need of help. Helping communities now helps contain EAB and slow the spread to other cities and slow the spread to our ash forests. Cities consistently tell us that they need to do inventory to identify where ash are located and their size. They need to develop management plans. They need to treat and remove ash. They need to replant diverse tree species, educate residents, and help homeowners with the removal costs and replacement. And without financial help and technical assistance, communities will be full of standing dead trees. So this map that you see indicates the distribution of grants that have been awarded across the state over the past 5 years. Thank you for this support. The pink areas are quarantined areas currently, and the red areas are EAB infested. Since 2019, with legislative funding, we've been able to provide about $25 million in grant funding, with another $7.2 million in funding anticipated to be released this summer. This is for part two or round two of last session's combined general fund and bonding support for community forestry grants. Since our first grant in 2019, through our most recent round, we've received requests for more than $65 million. And we've only been able to award funds to about 46% of the applications. Even with the increased funding, community need remains really high. A couple of emerging needs we've noted are that many communities want to provide assistance to low-income residents for what can be really costly tree removal or replacement. Beginning in 24, we were able to make some funding available via relief grants for this, but the need continues, and cities must often prioritize the funding that they get for the public trees. Also, many communities need large amounts of ongoing support because the ash might be a predominant species in their community, and capacity is low, and they're not able to treat the entire community in a single grant cycle. The EQB recommends $8.5 million a year through 2030 in order to manage the community EAB issues. We currently have two types of grants with funding made available from the 23 legislative session. The first is the community relief grants. We got $33 million requested from 151 applicants with about $6.8 million available in the first round. 38 projects will be funded for inventory, planting, assessment, treatment, removal, and more. New this year, nonprofit organizations were eligible along with local government and tribal nations. We also had a new eligible activity this year, support for low-income residents to offset the cost of tree removal. 82% of the projects will assist in areas of environmental justice concern, and relief recipients extend across the entire state, from Roseau to North St. Paul to Dodge County. It's across the whole state. We'll have about $6.8 million in grants for the second round this summer. The second type of grant is the Shade Tree Bonding Grants. $16.8 million was requested by 72 applications. About $10 million will be awarded via 43 projects for removal and replanting of shade trees. 73% of the bonding dollars were awarded to communities with areas of environmental justice concerns. There will be a small amount of bonding for this summer, and right now we're still working with communities to finalize many of the bonding grants and some of the relief grant contracts. So we don't have a list of final grant recipients until everybody finishes their paperwork. We should have that soon, and we intend to promote the final list of awardees as soon as we can, hopefully in the next month. We're happy to send a list of final grant recipients as soon as we have it to the committee chairs, as we've done in previous years. We anticipate having 161 contracts with communities and nonprofits between the two grants. Some of the grant contracts have been finalized, and I know one awardee is making that information public. They're able to do that. The city of Moorhead recently shared a news release about their Shade Tree Bonding Grant. So thank you for the continued support to help communities address EAB. I want to acknowledge that the success of this work is done with fantastic partnership with our sister agencies, Department of Agriculture and PCA, but also nonprofit organizations like the Minnesota Shade Tree Advisory Committee, tribal nations, and local county and city entities. And it's that strength of these relationships that is unified to address the threat of EAB in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Tillman, or Director Tiller. Director, sorry, my apology. Just one question. How successful are the agency reaching out to low-income community in terms of helping them with ash board reduction?
Mr. Chair, members, we did a series of outreach events, both in public and online, to allow people to attend in different ways. They were scattered across the state, outstate, as well as in the Twin Cities. And again, we had an online opportunity for communities to learn about this opportunity.
Okay, thank you. Looks like we have a question from Senator Quinnish. Senator Quinnish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the overview. going back to Ashbourne and having had this extremely, extremely mild winter, would you expect to see some serious issues in the spread or the loss of more trees due to Ashbourne?
Director Tiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator. We think a warmer winter doesn't necessarily speed it up, but a colder winter will slow it down. We would expect that it would continue to move at the current rate.
Thank you. Well, just one more
Follow up, Senator Kunesh. Yeah.
And this is more just a suggestion. I have a lot of manufactured home communities in my district, and unfortunately, we're seeing a trend of the owners who oftentimes are either out of state or out of the community that these manufactured home communities are in, are not, you know, perhaps investing in the best way in those communities. Have you ever thought about reaching out, and I'm talking about trees and planting and those sort of things, have you ever thought about specifically targeting them with opportunities and knowledge about some of these grants and opportunities that would not only enhance the manufactured home communities, but also perhaps work towards some of the climate change and environmental issues?
Director Tillum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator. That's a great idea, and that's something I'll bring back to staff for our work for the next grant cycle. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Taylor, for your presentation. Appreciate it. And so next we jump to Ecosystem Management Protection Section Manager on.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Well, Heidi Wolf is getting ready here. I just noticed the rest of our agenda and the time that we have left. So we're going to try to go as fast as we can. If you would like us to come back with some of these other ones at some point, we certainly could do that too, but we're just trying to deal with your work on your agenda here. So we're going to work through this one, and you can just let us know where we want to
go. I agree. Let's go ahead.
Go right ahead.
And welcome.
Thank you. I'm Heidi Wolf. I am the manager for the Ecosystem Management Protection Section at Minnesota DNR, here to talk about the 2024 update to the Minnesota Invasive Action Card Plan.
And Ms. Wolf, can you put the mic closer to the mouth?
Yeah, I sure can. So there was major springtime flooding in 2019 and 2023. We think that's why we saw more invasive carp in the state than we ever had before. You'll notice that more than 40 fish were tagged and tracked moving past open floodgates in 2023. Data suggests they were produced downstream, and from what we know right now, there's some intermittent reproduction up to pool 16. DNR has been managing invasive carp for a long time. We tag and track invasive carp. We contract with commercial fishers to remove them. We monitor for all life stages in Minnesota, and we develop and test methods to better capture and remove invasive carp. We're also coordinating with partners, since this isn't, of course, a one-state issue. We had a structured decision-making process in 2024 to inform the plan update. We wanted to make sure that we had other professionals there at the table with us and technical experts, as well as a values group who was citizens from the state. That was facilitated by the USGS, and a full report on that is forthcoming. No one action is sufficient, unfortunately, to deal with invasive carp. It has to be an integrated pest management system, because nothing will work completely. But we're hoping to layer different approaches. You'll notice that in the report that comes out, but expert scores reflected uncertainty about specific methods, and that's why, again, integrated pest management or layering those methods is very helpful. Five elements in the action plan: monitoring to support response actions, prevention and deterrent, response preparations, management and control, and communication outreach and coordination. You can see the full report and plan at this website. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. We're going to move this along, but just to see if anybody have question, and if not, we're... Thank you, Ms. Wolf.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heidi. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We will be back at any time to talk about this issue with you or any members have any individual concerns. Please let us know, but we'll be updating this often. Next, I'd like to bring up Deputy Director Pat Rivers. Provide an update on our elk restoration activities.
Okay, welcome, Mr. River. Go ahead and introduce yourself and go ahead with the presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the time to give a brief update on our elk relocation project. With support and direction from the Minnesota Legislature, the DNR is a partner with the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa on the band's proposal to restore elk to the Fond du Lac Reservation and surrounding area. Last year, the legislature provided $2.3 million to the Fond du Lac Band and the DNR for that effort. That language states, quote, consideration must be given to moving elk from existing herds in northwest Minnesota to the area of the Fond du Lac State Forest and Fond du Lac Reservation. Let me start by saying this project isn't about choosing elk in Carlton County over Kitson County. If we eventually do move elk, it won't come at the expense of the Grigla, Kitson Central, or Kitson or Caribou Vida herds. We are committed to having a self-sustaining elk herd in northwest Minnesota. There's a lot of interest in this project, notably from several tribal nations, agricultural producers, conservation organizations, local and county governments, among many others. These are the voices we have been and will continue to engage with as we further develop this project. On the screen are seven teams that the Fond du Lac Band and the DNR have assembled, and each of these teams are developing work plans to facilitate the possible movement of elk. I'd like to highlight just some of the work of the top four teams. The disease management team was busy this fall sampling elk and deer that were harvested by hunters in the Northwest looking for CWD and other diseases. There was also work done in the Carlton area looking at hunter-harvested deer. Disease management and risk is something we're very concerned about with this project and are monitoring through our fall hunts. Our depredation and conflict team is starting to work with landowners in the Northwest as well as the Northeast on how to minimize conflict. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture and the Minnesota DNR have active animal damage programs, and we're seeking ways we can make those programs work better for producers. Last year, the legislature passed the DNR initiative to make non-lethal hazing of deer and elk causing damage to crops illegal. This is a new tool that helps some, and we look forward to working with producers to find ways to make our programs work even more. Our Northeast Facilities and Release team is working with Carlton County identifying a place for a site to house elk and acclimate them to the Northeast should we move elk. That work is proceeding, and we have, I think, agreement with Carlton County on a place on county land to do that work. Finally, our information and engagement team is perhaps our busiest team, engaging with stakeholders and producing information on this project. Just today, Elk Notes, a newsletter that will be produced quarterly, was produced online, and you can sign up for that through Gov Delivery and keep up to date on all things elk related. The DNR hired an elk project coordinator. Her name is Kelsey Lashar. She was with our wildlife health program and is now going to be working full-time on this project. It's my understanding the Fond du Lac Band is also in the process of hiring an elk project coordinator. Mr. Chair, that's a very quick update on this project, and I thank you for the time.
Thank you, Mr. River. Deputy Director, any question from members? Okay, looks like we're doing well. I'd like to kind of interrupt the DNR presentation here and then let Commissioner Kessler come forward. So we can reserve, because we don't have one more, or maybe we might have Q&A, longer Q&A later, at later time or later date. Okay. Commissioner, thank you for your patience, and so go ahead with it, and just for the record, just go ahead and introduce yourself, and also when Director Johnson is ready to speak, he can go ahead and introduce himself as well.
Yeah, good afternoon, Chair Herr and members of the committee. My name's Katrina Kessler. I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and with me is our government relations director, Tom Johnson, and we are delighted to have this opportunity to walk through some of the work that we've been doing with the additional appropriations and direction that you all provided for us last year. And in case you have, been busy thinking about other things, you all did a tremendous amount of work last year, and we are very grateful for the investments that have come as part of that to the MPCA. So what I'm going to focus on today are the work that we're doing in support of our mission to protect human health and the environment, with the additional appropriations in some of the specific areas that I think are of most interest to members of the committee. And we're happy to answer questions about other things as well, or come back if there are other topics that people want to touch on. But today, I was planning to cover work that we have underway to implement new initiatives around environmental justice, PFAS, and climate change. So as you've heard, the Walz administration is working together across the agencies to make Minnesota the best state for kids and families. And one of the ways that vision manifests itself in the work of the MPCA is the investment that you all helped us make to build climate resiliency across communities. So those dollars that will help reinforce infrastructure and provide heat relief to communities and tribes will help children grow up and live and work in communities that are equipped for challenges that come along with climate change. So starting with the work around environmental justice, again, thank you for the investments that you made in the 2023 session. Specifically, I'm going to address a few of the items that we have underway. The 2023 Environmental and Natural Resource Omnibus Bill contained directive for the agency to address cumulative impacts in the pollution and air in the air permitting process. And this is nation-leading visions that you have all put out there. So we are really excited to be able to implement this work, and we started the rulemaking process to design the system by which this will be rolled out already this fall or last fall. We kicked it off with the initial public comment period, in which we held meetings with communities across the state that will be impacted, including 5 in-person meetings in the Twin Cities, or Duluth and Rochester, as well as 1 virtual meeting. And we are taking the feedback that we heard from participants in those sessions to help us define and create criteria to implement the new law over the next couple years. So here's a timeline. Rulemaking is not a fast process, but I think it's intentionally inclusive, especially in this case, and it's especially important in this case that we are working with the communities who are most impacted by the air pollution. So we're in the development phase of the rulemaking, and we have been holding co-learning conversations with communities on key concepts that will be included in the cumulative impacts law, along with nation-leading experts from other states and academia and community organizations who are also prioritizing cumulative impacts. So the legislature has given the MPCA 36 months to develop the rules, and we are on track to have a final rule in place with a hearing in the summer of 2026 and implementation in the fall of 2026. And I'll just for additional context say, what this means is that when permits come up for reissuance in environmental justice areas, that we will not just be looking at one source of pollution from one individual facility, but looking at the entire burden that community faces, not only from point source pollution, but from other stressors, and that we need to be working with project proposers to make sure that we are not exceeding a threshold by which a community cannot handle. And so in order to do that well, we need to be working with communities to understand the stressors, to understand how to include their lived experiences in our scientific processes, and that is the work that we are undertaking right now. Another area of new investment, new initiative that came out of the 2023 session is the direction for the MPCA to establish a community air monitoring program. So we do a lot of regulatory monitoring towards direction that EPA has set, and we recognize that in order to really meet the moment of 2023, we need to have monitoring that is inclusive of communities and has communities understanding their burden in terms of air pollution and how they can be more involved in the process. So we completed a public feedback period with community input on how we can build this program, because this is entirely new, and we at this point we are just taking the feedback. And I'll just point out that one thing that we heard loud and clear was the need for ongoing engagement throughout the process. And I think that matches the understanding that we have and that the direction that you all have given us, because this really is to be inclusive of community members. And so the grants for these programs should be expecting to launch in the coming months. And we are still working through with communities to understand, do we need to set this up in such a way that it goes to community organizations, to academics who can work with community organizations, because we also want to make sure that the data that are produced from the program can be used by the agency. And so there are quality assurance processes and calibration methods that need to be followed. And we want to make sure that we're setting those community monitors up for success. Another new initiative within the area of environmental justice is the directive to better regulate air toxics. So this is a new program that we are standing up, and we are in the early stages of rulemaking to implement this law. We actually held a virtual information session earlier this week to hear from interested parties. And I'll just note that some of the other items that I talked about are focused on environmental justice communities, whether it's in the Twin Cities metro area or in outstate. And this rule in particular will impact all 7 metro counties, and it's not limited to environmental justice areas within that geographic boundary. We're currently reviewing rules and laws that have been passed in other states that are similar to the direction we believe the legislature has given us around air toxics. And this rulemaking, as you can see here, is on a similar timeline to the cumulative impacts law. And so the goal of adoption is the fall of 2026. So shifting gears now to PFAS and our work to implement the ambitious new legislation that you all directed us to take on, including Amara's Law. And unfortunately, at this point, we are all very familiar with PFAS, you know, the 5,000 plus chemicals that do not break down over time. They threaten our health, aquatic life, wildlife, drinking water, and ubiquitously move across the environment. And we know that PFAS have been associated with adverse health effects and environmental damage at very low levels. So at the MPCA, thinking about this challenge that touches all of us, we are really focused on prevention and then managing and mitigating and cleaning up when we can't prevent. And I just want to say thanks again to the work that you all have been doing to support the direction around prevention and avoiding PFAS. This slide shows not just the Amara's Law that we are working on to build out right now, but other work that the MPCA has been implementing that came out of previous legislative sessions, including a ban on PFAS in types of firefighting foam and food packaging, as well as the comprehensive Amara's Law. And I'll just remind folks that law has several dates in it that are significant. It bans intentionally added PFAS in 11 specific product categories on January 1st of 2025. So that is less than a year away at this point. And so we have been busy meeting with people, answering questions, and putting together frequently asked questions and guidance for folks so that they can understand whether or not you're a regulated party or you're a consumer or you're a user or a manufacturer, how you are impacted by the ban or the prohibition that will take place next year. It also requires the MPCA to undertake rulemaking to establish a reporting structure for PFAS manufacturers to tell us if there are PFAS in their products, and a fee structure for those that are using PFAS to pay into the system, as well as then the final date is a prohibition on the sale of PFAS with intentionally, or of the sale of products with intentionally added PFAS, that unless there is currently unavoidable use as determined by the rule. So lots of kind of wonky terms there, but essentially what this does, it says next year we know that there are PFAS in 11 categories and we can't have that anymore, and then we will set up a system by which we will gather information from people to understand where PFAS are, as well as build a system where people can apply for the agency to determine if they truly have an intentionally added PFAS that is unavoidable. So there will be a petition process by which manufacturers can make that case to the agency, and we're building that out through rulemaking. And then on or after January 1st of 2032, unless you have received an exemption from the agency, all uses of PFAS are banned. And I'll just say that this is an area where we're receiving a lot of interest, and that we are forming two work groups that are inclusive of subject matter experts that come from technical backgrounds, academic backgrounds, nonprofits, as well as regulated party and industry, so that we can have smaller conversations with folks who will be most impacted or are most interested in how to build out these systems through the rulemaking process. And there will be opportunities along the way for more broad interaction and input, but I want to, just in case all of you are getting questions or you have questions for the agency, we want to be a resource for you and for others, and we're happy to talk more about that with you or your constituents. And MARA's law and the associated laws that were passed last year is only one part of the agency's work. Up here, I've highlighted two important documents that are really foundational to the way that we are approaching PFAS. The first is the PFAS blueprint that has been in place now for several years, and it calls for addressing PFAS across a number of areas, including research and toxicity and treatment and understanding the way that sources of PFAS move through the environment. And then the other, which what we published the year after, is really the MPCA's monitoring plan to look at those that have permits from the MPCA, how are we characterizing those sources, and then working with those permitted entities to really mitigate and minimize and then treat if we can't get it out of the system up front. And I want to thank the legislature for another grant opportunity that you all made available last year, recognizing that we need to support this work, not at just the state level, but at the local level. We received $4 million in grants that we have begun to talk to people about how to distribute to local governments and businesses to reduce sources of PFAS. So the grantees would be able to use the money to identify product and processes that they can change or replace. They could use it to design treatment strategies and to monitor effectiveness of change. So I think it's really important that we recognize that we're nation leading in this area, and we need to support all elements of the system as we move through this change, and that's the work that the agency is trying to do at this point. The last PFAS grant that I want to highlight is $22 million that was appropriated last year to help public water suppliers plan and design upgrades to address the PFAS treatment costs. And we know that the Minnesota Department of Health has new health-based guidance, and we are expecting new maximum contaminant levels or regulatory thresholds coming from the U.S. EPA that will impact a number of communities across the state. And so we appreciate the vision that the legislature put out there to make sure that we also are providing opportunities to support systems that will be impacted and need to reduce PFAS. So we are accepting applications for these grants right now through June 28th, and we're going to give them out on a first-come, first-served basis. So if you know of communities or treatment systems that might be impacted and interested in this, we would be happy to provide you more information and would encourage you to share this. And the maximum grant will be dependent on the size of the facility and the cost-effectiveness of the project. And then I just want to just close on the PFAS topic to again say thank you for the work that you are all doing and allowing us to do to protect Minnesotans from PFAS pollution. Our goal is to disrupt the flow of PFAS. You can see up here that it is moving across all elements of society, all aspects of society, and impacts us as humans as well as wildlife. And we need to think about the way that we are doing our work now to really disrupt this and cut off the flow and then ultimately work to have less and a safer and healthier environment. So shifting to climate now, as you are all aware, the increasing threats from our changing climate are more visible month by month and year by year. This is a picture that was taken in Stillwater last year when we had historic flooding that followed the significant snowfall that we had last year. And it's hard to think about that winter and couldn't be more different than this winter, although we did have snow last night. We went from like one of the snowiest winters on record to essentially one of the least snowy winters on records. And these extremes really underscore the need to really do our best to implement the work that you have made it possible for us to carry out. So I want to just highlight one more time the $100 million in climate resiliency grants. And this grew out of a smaller appropriation, the previous biennium, which was a $2 million grant award or pot of money that could be used for grants for communities to plan for resilience. And these are the communities that received grants through that $2 million award pot of money. And we have, and we had exponentially more interest in that program, which informed the work that we were able to do with you last year for the $100 million. And I'll say that we have been busy working with communities and tribes to get those dollars out the door. We've had several rounds of RFPs. In the first round, we really focused on communities of less than 10,000 people. We had 21 applications totaling more than $1.3 million. The pot of money that we put out for the first RFP was $500,000, so we had more than double the amount of requests for that first RFP. We had a second round that wasn't limited to communities of 10,000, but again, we saw more than the amount of money we put out in demand, and we currently have applications open for another round of grants, and this one is open for $35 million, where the others have been more closer to like the $1 or $2 million because we are focused on planning. Now we are seeing communities across the state that actually have climate resilient plans and prioritization plans in place, and so we want to make sure that we are making money available for them to do the capital investment that is called for in their plans. Recognizing that methane from waste is a powerful greenhouse gas, it's important that we also appreciate the investment that you all have made it possible for us to make in reducing our waste and building recycling and composting systems across the state. You all helped appropriate $22 million last year, and we have opened the RFP for these dollars, which will be granted out in phases. The first one, which we made possible last October, was focused on waste reuse and reduction. We put out $1 million as that first one, and we got 27 applications for almost $4 million. So there is demand for this, and we will be phasing these out over the course of the year in quarterly opportunities. So again, this is one that's available to communities across the state. We often hear from people, oh, we used to have recycling in our community, but it wasn't cost effective. And these dollars can be used to develop economic opportunities and markets in local communities and focus on things like refrigeration products for food shelves, helping multifamily housing implement composting programs, funding equipment for manufacturers that use recycled materials, or salvaging construction waste so that we have less ending up in the landfills. All right, Tom is suggesting that I might pause for questions.
Senator McHugh.
Thank you very much. I had a question about the grants. What is sort of the average grantee receiving for these grants? Do you have a number? And if you don't know, that's fine. But I was just wondering sort of what the scope that we're talking about with these grants is. And then also, can you let us know sort of who is applicable to be able to apply for and receive these? Like specifically, I'm wondering about school districts.
Yeah.
Commissioner.
Chair Herr and Senator McHugh, an excellent question. I don't know exactly how much money people are getting, but I will say that the types of projects that we know are eligible range in cost from small amounts to large amounts. And we have the $22 million, and we're hoping to give it out over the course of the year. So that would mean that we would be able to fund, you know, four rounds of up to $5 million, a little bit more than that each round. And so there's room in there for smaller projects as well as larger projects. But I can follow up with specifics, and I would say that school districts would be eligible to apply. Yeah, well, Tom would also like to add.
Mr. Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, Tom Johnson, Government Relations with MPCA. Just wanted to highlight that out of this $22 million, there were several different opportunities for grants within that. So there were, I believe it was, and I'll have to, again, we'll get specifics to you, but I believe it was $2 million for reuse. There was food waste grants in there. There's items for wood waste. So really, we tried to address a number of different topics within there. So within those categories, for example, food waste, I know there's a lot of opportunities for food rescue nonprofits to be involved in that work and other areas. So it really is addressing a broad range of areas.
Okay. Thank you. And continue, Commissioner, with your presentation.
I'm happy to continue. I'll just add one more thing, and I'm not sure if this addresses Senator McEwen's question, but I know that previously we have given grants out under this umbrella to school districts that have partnered with local utilities to build out composting programs, for example. So we are familiar with that type of partnership and very supportive of that. So just wanted to touch a little bit on a few other areas that I think may be of interest to the committee that grew not necessarily just out of last session, but out of other work that we have been able to do with all of you, and happy to take questions about these or other items that may be of interest. Wanted to again say thank you to you all for the historic investment that you have made in the work of the agency that furthers the mission of the agency. And I'll just pause and say a lot of what we've been focused on to support the things that I've talked about is hiring people so that we can really meet this opportunity. And one of the things that we're very focused on is hiring people that are representative of the people that we serve across the state of Minnesota. So we've prioritized the hiring in the areas of climate change, of PFAS, as well as the environmental justice work. And I know that many of you have talented and passionate professionals in your districts, and I have provided this previously to Chair Herr, but I think we would very much encourage your support in encouraging people to come help the MPCA do this work well. I looked this morning, I think we have 10 vacancies right now that are available for people, and they range from like entry-level positions all the way up to more technical positions, and would welcome your sharing that as an opportunity. And again, want to say thank you. One thing that did come out of the session last year was the direction for the commissioners of the Department of Health, as well as Ag and PCA and DNR, to prepare a report with recommendations for changes in statutes and rules to prevent fish kills in the southeastern part of the state. And the agencies delivered that report to the legislature on January 15th of this year with a number of recommendations. And I just want to highlight a couple that fall within the work of the MPCA. One is the recommendation to update the feedlot permit rules to prohibit manure application in the floodplain. And I'll say, you know, these rules are 20 years old, and this is something that we have been talking about and had been talking about previous to the development of this report, and are excited to be able to continue moving forward with this, as well as other recommendations within the report and other changes to our regulatory structure. One of the other things that it recommends is that we work with researchers to evaluate options for reducing runoff from hay fields during the summer and to evaluate current setback requirements when manure is applied in the floodplain in light of extreme weather. And I think this kind of highlights the connection and the nexus between climate and land use and water quality, and we need to be really thinking about what we're experiencing across all of those areas in 2023 and how our systems are set up to support producers, as well as public health, as well as environmental health and water quality. And the recommendations in this report will allow us to work together to think about changes not only in the MPCA's purview, but within those other agencies as well. And I'll just say that there are several recommendations that call for the agency to work with the legislature to develop and fund cost share programs to improve liquid manure storage capacity, encourage cover crop planting, and hire more dedicated staff in the southeastern part of the state. So last thing on here, the legislature directed the agency to develop an interagency protocol for responding to fish kills, and that we are public noticing that protocol in March, so coming up, and would invite people to weigh in on that. Another thing that I think may be of interest to the committee is work on the Pig's Eye Dump, or the Pig's Eye Task Force. The 2022 legislature created the Pig's Eye Task Force to coordinate efforts to remediate and restore the historic Pig's Eye Dump. And this concern stems from historic improper waste disposal that happened in the mid-1900s. And despite efforts to clean up the dump in the early 2000s, there are significant environmental concerns that remain related to PFAS, dioxin, and metals. And the task force brings together representatives of state and local government, as well as federal agencies and others responsible for helping us set a vision and implement what the land use and the future can be in this area. The task force is responsible for reporting back to the legislature on February 15th of 2026 with a proposal to restore the site, and they are on track to meet that deadline. Just a little bit more about this site. It is of environmental significance because it is located within the Mississippi River floodplain, and the Battle Creek flows directly through the central portion of the dump and ends in Pig's Eye Lake. And we know that today, this area also includes a regional park and is a homeland, is the Dakota Homeland Sacred Site, and also includes a DNR heron rookery scientific and natural area. So there's a lot of already aspirational uses happening there, and we want to make sure that the task force is successful in their work so that we can really manifest the vision that we think we all can see in this significant location. And the very last thing that I want to touch on that I think may be of interest to members of the community is plastic pollution. So this is small in size, but significant not only in Minnesota, but elsewhere. Plastic pollution has raised concerns worldwide. We know that millions of tons are released annually, and it's transported through the ecosystem and in very, very tiny pieces, but so microscopic that you can't see it. And it has negative ecological and human health impacts. So the 2023 legislature funded MPCA to work on developing sampling methods for micro and nano plastic pollution. The appropriation is $500,000 to develop the protocols that would be available for all agencies and departments to use to test groundwater, surface water, public drinking water, and private wells, and to be able to begin that implementation. And the project is on track to deliver those protocols. So just wanted to call that out as well. And with that, Chair Herr and members of the committee, thank you very much again for the opportunity. Thank you for your support, and we're happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Commissioner and Mr. Johnson, for giving a very thorough report in a span of 30 minutes, which is I'll be out of breath for 30 minutes, but you did very well, Commissioner. any question from members or comments? So thank you, Commissioner. You did an excellent job, and I really appreciate you expressing much gratitude and credit to us legislators who have passed the historical investment to our state in terms of pollution control. But everyone has a part in it, everybody, including your leadership as well, Commissioner. And so thank you also that you been very steadfast in making sure that the Amara law is implemented well. So, and you have spoken great length about that, so appreciate your report. So if members don't have any question, I would like to conclude Commissioner testimony, but I want to see if anybody out there in the audience want to testify, whether it's in support of comments regarding testimony from the DNR and testimony from our Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Okay, looks like there's no testimony. So thank you all for listening to the testimony. And again, welcome back to the new session. And it'll be, we'll make it fun. It'll be fun. And if not, we'll make it fun and productive and according to the people that put us here in office. So looking forward for 10 more committee sessions or more, if possible, that will be engaging with policy, environment and natural resource, climate, and as well as legacy from our members. So thank you with that. I will adjourn and we'll post the next hearing. Just look up on our website and also information online. Okay, thank you very much, and meeting is adjourned.